This is a podcast from ABC Radio National. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times, and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello everyone, and welcome to The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National. I'm Mick O'Regan. This week on the program, we're looking at a new sport that claims to pack an intellectual punch, sort of literally. Yes, if you thought that Boris Spassky and Mike Tyson were worlds apart, then you may need to think again. There's finally a contact sport that's interested in blending brain and brawn. And also this week, we'll take in the view from the Caribbean, where everything from calypso to reggae to traditional storytelling has a role to play in the development of cricket.
Now, you can almost follow the growth of West Indies cricket from the very early days in the 1920s and 30s to the present period of woe by listening to the calypsos of different eras, because, again, you would have great calypsonians over the years dictating the stories of great series that would have been won, great moments in West Indies cricket, low moments in West Indies cricket. And that really has become almost a culture in the Caribbean, where the art of singing, the art of calypso, the art of reggae, the various forms of those art forms in the Caribbean are basically more storytelling than just pure entertainment.
The Caribbean Calling, sports commentator Fazia Mohammed on life and sport in his tropical homeland a little later. And also in the program, just days after a prominent Australian golfer cast serious doubts on the status of the professional tour here, we'll speak to the new chief executive of Golf Australia, Tony Hallam. But first to a strange sporting hybrid, a combination of two pursuits that seem worlds apart, yet have been brought together in a competitive format, chess and boxing.
WBCO World Chess Boxing Organization. Let's go!
Well, he sounds enthusiastic, and who knows, maybe he even understands what happens at a chess boxing tournament. The idea of chess boxing sprouted from the pages of a futuristic sci-fi cartoon set in the 22nd century, but it found material form when the Dutch performance artist Jippe Rubing organised a competition. One of his closest collaborators is Andreas Dilschneider, a German who contested the recent European chess boxing championships. I asked Andreas if people were actually taking the sport seriously.
Absolutely. At the beginning, for Ipe, it was something like an art event. It was something like a show. But now, during something like of 2-3 years doing the sport, it came up more and more that it's really something like a serious sport, and we are really doing it like a serious sport. 3 months ago, we founded here in Berlin the first chess boxing club Berlin, which is definitely the first chess boxing club worldwide. And now we have something like 22 members, and we do regular training 2 times a week. And yeah.
Okay, so just to clarify this, chess boxing involves a mixture of chess, the board game, and boxing, as in, you know, pugilism. And basically that the players, they have interchanging 4-minute rounds of chess and 2-minute rounds of boxing. There's a maximum of 11 rounds, and you can either win by winning the boxing or by winning the chess?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. The decision falls immediately. So if you have something like a knockout in the boxing, the game is immediately over. And if you have something like a checkmate in chess, also the game is over. The difficulty is the alternating thing. So you don't do something like first the chess and then the boxing. So you have one chess round, then the boxing round, and then the chess round. And that means if you come out of the boxing round, you have a very high pulse, you have a very high adrenaline, and you have to deal with that in the chess round. And that's the goal, that's the really difficult thing. So you really need a very good physical condition. You have to be very good prepared, because you have to think 2-3 times more about a move in chess than in a usual normal chess game.
Do you think there might be players who'll just come in on the prowess, on their ability to box, and basically not worry about trying to win the chess game? They'll just try and knock the other player out?
It was very difficult in the beginning to find the rules for this game, you know, because we're trying to look for that we have an kind of a equal value for the chess and the equal value for the boxing. So for that, we have 6 chess rounds. We start with a chess round. To qualify for a championship fight, you also have to prove that you can play chess. So it's not allowed to have something like a gold medalist in boxing who don't know anyhow to play chess. So we have something like now candidates from all over the world who want to compete in chess boxing fights. And if they don't have an ELO rating, which is the international something like value how strong you are as a chess player, and we test them on the internet by playing with them chess, how their chess skills are.
So the idea is that you have to be a decent chess player. You can't just be a boxer who doesn't really know a rook from a pawn.
Yes, you have to be a chess player, definitely. But there, usually the press makes this kind of a prejudice, like boxers are stupid and they don't know how to play chess, and chess players are really like physical nerds or something like that. But that's not true. We have many chess players, and we have many boxers. You know, the most boxers I know are super clever and very smart. And it's not like that, you know. We have really plenty of people.
Though it is interesting, Andreas. I mean, one of the issues that arises about the health and welfare of boxers is that too many blows to the head can basically impair your brain function. Is it more difficult later in the boxing rounds for people to concentrate on the chess?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely very difficult. Even for me myself, I done this the European Championship fight against a Bulgarian guy, and it's also a question of the oxygen in the head, because you just lose concentration, you know. So you have always to be very aware, even in the boxing rounds, don't lose the goal, you know. It's very interesting because, you know, at one moment it sounds very absurd to combine chess and boxing.
It does,
but in
yes.
both sports you have parallels, you know. It's about two opponents. It's about taking and giving. You always have to react on what your opponent is doing. That's exactly the same in chess and exactly the same in boxing. And you don't have to lose the goal. So it's just like the one is really mental and the one is really physical. We're something like an intellectual fight club. For sure, it's very difficult not to lose the concentration in chess, but it's possible.
Do you think there will ever be professional chess boxers?
We will see, you know. At the beginning, we thought, we started, it was something like an art thing. Now it became more and more something like a really serious sport, which can be trained. We are developing a new training method with scientists, with sports scientists. And we will see. We will have in the beginning of February, we will have new championship fights here in Cologne. We are planning to do fights in Britain and in the USA. And we are also calling Australia to prove that you have guys who not only can fight, who also can think. So we have an internet page on wcbo.org, and you can file out a form there if you want to applicate as a fighter. And yeah, we're waiting for you.
just finally, the other thing that I found somewhat alarming, I have to admit, was that chess boxing has Olympic dreams. You'd like to see this as an Olympic event. Is that just a bit of publicity to build up public attention, or are you seriously saying that chess boxing might be considered as an Olympic event?
No, you see, we're at the beginning, you know, and in the end, you know, everybody who's doing a sport or who's inventing a sport has this dream to become as an Olympic thing, you know. As you can see, like something like 20, 30 years ago when triathlon started, everybody thought it's totally stupid, you know, to do 100 kilometers of bicycling and 40 kilometers of running and 4 kilometers of swimming. And, you know, now you have something like Olympic form of it, you know. We're just at the beginning. And it comes out now that it's really a serious sport, that many people around the world are really very curious and very interested about it. Let's see how it works, you know.
Well, I'm fascinated by it, and I look forward to seeing how the sport progresses. Thank you very much for taking our call and for being on The Sports Factor on ABC Radio National.
Yes, thank you. You're welcome.
Andreas Dillschneider, better known simply as D, the official spokesperson for the World Chess Boxing Organization. Yes, it is a sport. And this is The Sports Factor, around the country on ABC Radio National, across the region via Radio Australia, and all over the world through ABC Online. I'm Mick O'Regan.
When the big gloved hand of Socceroo goalkeeper Mark Schwarzer and the swinging boot of striker John Aloisi secured Australia's passage to the finals of the Football World Cup next year in Germany, the place went crazy. Yet, compared to the smallest nation to qualify, we Australians seem positively restrained. In Trinidad and Tobago, across in the Caribbean, they immediately declared a public holiday, by presidential decree no less. At the moment, one of the Caribbean's best-known sports broadcasters is in Australia, commentating on the West Indian cricket series. His name is Fazir Mohammed, and he's the voice of cricket for tens of thousands of fans back in the Caribbean. One aspect of sports broadcasting in the West Indies is the debt that it owes to the much older tradition of folk storytelling. Fazir Mohammed argues that the game has been encouraged in the Caribbean by drawing on the talents of performers like Paul Keynes Douglas and Louise Bennett, who united the oral tradition of storytelling with the regional passion for cricket.
Well, it really is the definition of understanding the game of cricket, particularly in the West Indies. Cricket is bound to the West Indies almost basically from the inception of the idea of Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, Barbados, all of the territories that play the game of cricket, the former British West Indies territories. They are inextricably bound to the game of cricket because of that connection with the British. Were it not for cricket, were it not for the British and their concept of the West Indies playing cricket, there really would not be a West Indies cricket team, because there is no other sport that the Caribbean territories from the English-speaking Caribbean play in together other than cricket. They would play separately at the Commonwealth Games next March in Melbourne. They would participate at the Olympic Games in football. Trinidad and Tobago have qualified for the World Cup. Jamaica have qualified, and not the West Indies. And in that oral tradition, you have a situation where over the years, people have grown up. It is almost a legacy of the days of African slaves coming over to the Caribbean, the days of indentured labourers coming to the Caribbean after the African slaves, and developing that tradition of storytelling. And that exists now into the 21st century, where you have individuals like Paul Keynes Douglas, like Louise Bennett, and they have carried on the tradition, basically, of telling tales of almost embellishing the tales of great heroes with the dialect, in the West Indian dialect, with poetry, with songs of great performances. And that also extends itself to the calypsos. Now, you can almost follow the growth of West Indies cricket from the very early days in the 1920s and 30s to the present period of woe by listening to the calypsos of different eras, because, again, you would have great calypsonians over the years dictating the stories of great series that would have been won, great moments in West Indies cricket, low moments in West Indies cricket. And that really has become almost a culture in the Caribbean, where the art of singing, the art of calypso, the art of reggae, the various forms of those art forms in the Caribbean are basically more storytelling than just pure entertainment.
Now that storytelling, that's quite separate, say, from the tradition in Australia of wits in the crowd, you know, throwing out heckling comments to players. I mean, the classic one would be in Australia to encourage a batsman to play his shots is "have a go, you mug." But we're not talking about banter from the audience at a ground, are we? This is a different thing, this oral tradition.
Yes, it is. It is a very different thing. It is almost, I would say, formalized in many respects. You do have that bit of banter in the crowd itself. That's a very different aspect of the Caribbean cricketing experience. But it is very, very popular for many a West Indian cricket fan to listen to the calypsos that would have told the stories of Series 1 against Australia in 1965, the great Gary Sobers, the famous Test Series triumph in England in 1950. There's a famous photograph of that match at Lord's with one of the great Calypsonians of the time who passed away just a few years ago, the Lord Kitchener from Trinidad and Tobago, walking across the hallowed turf at Lord's with his guitar and his band of supporting singers and doing a calypso in tribute of that performance with the great Ramadan and Valentine and the three W's and so on. So it isn't necessarily just the spectator with the have a go your mug sort of thing. It is really formalized and it becomes part of the folklore, part of the culture, and it is recorded in wax and now on CDs and what have you, with the songs that have been sung, the stories that have been told, and indeed it recalls much of the history much better than even some of the written works would have done over the years.
Fazir, I'd like to now talk about the cycle of success and defeat in world cricket, because obviously at the moment the West Indies team that's currently touring Australia while a competent team in many ways is only a shadow of some of the great teams of the 1980s, what do you think are the factors that currently underpin the West Indies' sort of position on the loss cycle, if you like, as opposed to when they were dominating world cricket?
Mick, it's a very complicated sort of situation. I don't think there's any definitive answer. What I can say, though, as I was mentioning earlier, because cricket is so inextricably bound to societies in the Caribbean, even now as the West Indies have been losing so badly over the last decade and slipping further and further down the ladder, there is the fear that it might become irrelevant, particularly with other interests developing in other sports and other factors for young people around the Caribbean. But still, people still agonize over the West Indies losing. It is almost a perverse sort of agonizing where they can't help but listen and follow what is happening to their beloved team. And it is reflective of what is happening very much in the societies of the former British West Indies, where the societies are under constant stresses and strains. There's a theory that has been developed by a Dr. Hilary Beckles, who is at the University of the West Indies, and his chair deals with the whole issue of cricket and its role in the societies of the Caribbean. And he has almost defined different eras, and he talks about this particular era where individuals are preoccupied by their individual gains and achievements in sport, as distinct from an earlier era, the 50s, 60s and 70s, when there was a certain pride and a feeling of identity with the Caribbean, of playing for the West Indies to take on the might of the former colonial masters and so on. One saw that certainly very, very proudly and almost arrogantly in the captaincy and the leadership of a Vivian Richards. Now, that is quickly dissipated because we're all consumerist societies. We're preoccupied in the main with the young people pursuing those Western-style consumerist values, and you're not seeing that pride that defined the West Indies. There is clearly the talent there. There's no question about it. When you look at, for example, Dinesh Ramdin and Dwayne Bravo, how they batted in that partnership in Hobart in the second test match, how some of the bowlers have bowled occasionally, and of course, Brian Lara, his own individual ability and his achievements, that will tell you that there is talent there. But there doesn't seem to be, at least in this particular generation, the great pride of being a West Indian, the great pride of carrying on the heritage of representing the West Indies at cricket and taking on the might of the world and beating them at their own game. And I think this is where the West Indies are hurting the most. You find it very difficult to see how there's going to be an immediate resolution to this particular dilemma, because, as I said before, it seems almost unique that you've got a situation where a cricket team, a sport, and the game of cricket is so very much tied in to the ebbs and tides and the flows of Caribbean society. And I think at the moment, with the struggles that we're facing in many respects, crime and the drug trade or other factors that come into the mix that are deflecting interest in our young people from sport and other healthy pursuits, and all of this is almost snowballing at this stage, at this era of West Indies cricket.
Now, if we look at other sports, I mean, beyond those social conditions that you've alluded to, as you mentioned, Trinidad and Tobago have just qualified, like Australia, for the 2016 World Cup in Germany. Now, obviously, you were here covering the cricket tour when that last tie was played against Bahrain. But I imagine in Trinidad and Tobago, there were scenes on a smaller scale that emulated the scenes in Australia that you would have witnessed.
Well, in a strange sort of way, I would probably want to venture to suggest, with a country of over 1.3 million people, it almost shut the country down. It is in many respects in contrast to Australia, in the sense that, yes, there was nationwide celebration, but there almost seems to be a reluctance to accept football or soccer as you know it in Australia as such a global phenomenon, because everyone is preoccupied first with the cricket in the summer and then the various codes of football in the winter. Whereas in Trinidad and Tobago, it's basically everyone was so obsessed with Trinidad and Tobago making it to the World Cup that the country virtually shut down that Wednesday afternoon Trinidad time when they got that 1-0 victory. A national holiday was declared the very next day. And I can tell you the sense of euphoria will go well into the month of June next year when eventually the World Cup is played. So it is a tremendous high for the country at a time when there are many difficulties with crime and violence and so on. And it is almost a release from the pressures of daily life.
Is football and the sort of money and fame that it can attract, does it pose a long-term threat to the health of cricket in the Caribbean?
I don't think it does. I think really football has always been very, very popular in the Caribbean. Obviously, it has come to the fore over the last 10 years or so, with Jamaica qualifying in 1998 for the World Cup, Trinidad and Tobago now qualifying for Germany 2006. But football has always been a very, very close second to cricket. And if anything, in the earlier era of West Indies cricket, the 50s, the 60s, even going further back, and even to the 70s, going forward again, you'd have a situation where players played cricket and football. Not many people are aware that Viv Richards, the former West Indies captain, has the unique distinction of playing World Cup football and World Cup cricket for Antigua. He played in the World Cup qualifiers for Antigua Barbuda, his home island. So it was normal to play football as well. So now that you have a situation where football is growing in its popularity, it may seem as a threat, but football has always been very popular. But more and more players are moving into the European leagues. They're leading lives which are far more materialistically oriented. They're well paid, they're well compensated compared to cricket. And even at the lower levels in the English league, there are many players of West Indian extraction, West Indian players, Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, St. Vincent, St. Lucia. A lot of these players, Barbados as well, Grenada, are involved in the European leagues and in other parts of the world, in far Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Japan, and so on. So there is that allure of going towards football, but I wouldn't say it's a threat. I think it's healthy that you've got so many youngsters wanting to go towards football, because cricket sometimes tends to have become complacent over the years, and only now are many administrators waking up and recognizing they need to do a lot more than just simply take cricket for granted.
Fazia, as a final question, I'm sure that being a professional cricket commentator has thrown you up against all sorts of spoken English, but I'm just wondering, to share broadcasting with Australia's Kerry O'Keefe, has that given you new insights into English and how it's used here in Australia?
That's putting it mildly. I often wonder if it's actually English that is being spoken sometimes. And in fact, Kerry, in between his bouts of humour and his fits of laughter, which continue to amuse many people in the West Indies, and I know it infuriates some as well, he often asks the question, is some of his humour over the top, or is it a question of maybe people back in the West Indies not really getting what he says if it tends to be too much in-house, or at least as far as Australian audiences would be concerned. But I think people generally enjoy that. And I enjoy working with Kerry. I think that cricket, particularly because of the nature of commentary, you can't be talking for 6 hours generally and just saying the score is this and the score was that and this one is bowling to that one. There are too many factors interwoven in cricket to just simply talk about those factors. And if you've got raucous comedy along the way, well, it just helps.
Indeed it does. Fazia Mohammed, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National.
A pleasure, Mick.
West Indian cricket commentator and sports broadcaster Fazia Mohammed. I'm Mick O'Regan, and you're listening to The Sports Factor on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and through ABC Online. Golf is big news in Australia this week. The game has a new peak body and a new chief executive, Tony Hallam. But it's also under fire from past champions like Peter Thompson and current professionals like Adam Scott, who argue the local pro tour just isn't up to scratch. Too little money, too few major sponsors, and too few major events. Peter Thompson even suggested it would be better to see the local competition as a player development event rather than a fully-fledged tour. So, given the bad press the Australasian Pro Tour has endured this week, I asked Tony Hallam if just now was a tough time to take over golf.
Well, Mick, I think it's a great time to come into my new job. I suppose I'm terribly excited about the opportunity because golf is just so fundamentally sound and such a fundamental part of Australian community. I mean, we have officially 1.4 million people in Australia who play. They're anywhere from the age of 6 years of age through to 90 years of age. They're men and women, junior, senior, elite amateur, elite professional, and then your average punter who goes out either as a member of a club or a social player and tries to belt that white ball around and perfect their game. And one of the beauties of the game is that it is a game for life and it's a game for everybody. Certainly there's been a lot of discussion around the professional tour and the healthiness of that, and that in itself is a real challenge, primarily because the tour, other than providing a wonderful lifestyle and a career for the professional players, its role for me in our constituency is about inspiring young Australians to play what is just a magnificent game and to take on the world And the role of elite sport, I think, from an inspirational perspective, is to illustrate to Australians that, you know, they can go and take on the world and beat the best. And
but it is interesting, Tony, that players like the former legend, or, you know, the legendary player Peter Thompson, a five times winner of the British Open, he's made the point that maybe we should see the professional tour in Australia as simply a tour to develop younger talents and not try to compete with the major tours in the European capitals or in the States.
Look, and I think Peter's an icon of the game, and clearly we need to respect his opinions and his views. He's been around the game for a long time, and I can't really comment, I suppose, on what Peter's had. I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet. But
does it surprise you that he's got that view?
Well, no, what I would say, I think, is that we have, in men's golf, 11 of the top 100 players in the world. And on the women's side, we have, you know, arguably Australia's best ever golfer in Carrie Webb, who's won 6 major championships. We have Rachel Hetherington, who finished 32nd on the professional tour in the United States. So it's an enormously strong game from an elite level, and we should be really proud of what those golfers have achieved overseas in what is an incredibly competitive game in terms of the development around the world and the tours around the world and the number of countries that are producing elite players. So I think, you know, we should, if I just finished watching the end of the day's play for the first day of the Australian Open, and, you know, to have that field and have Adam Scott, number 8 in the world, and Robert Allenby and Stuart Appleby and Mark Hensby, and in that field are 8 winners from the US Tour. So I think we just should be really proud as Australians that we've delivered and produced that quality of golfer. And I think one of the challenges is to make sure we have a tour that gives young Australians, old Australians, people who love golf, people who love sport, give them the chance to watch elite sport at a golfing level live in their country, because that's really what has built on. If we look at, 30 years ago, Greg Norman bursting on the scene, he built on what was a fantastic tradition from people like Peter Thompson, and we're building on it now with just a magnificent group of men and women, professional elite golfers who are successful around the world.
And yet, I would concur with almost all of what you've said, but the fact remains that, for example, prize money is down in Australia this year, and also the number of major events has dwindled from something in the order of 20 a few years ago right down to just 4 this year.
Oh, and I think everybody's aware of the facts of the situation. But again, I come back to sort of what we talked about. We have 3 fantastic men's events in the next 3 weeks. We have 3 more in February. But to be frank, I think the bigger immediate issue for me is, as the head of Golf Australia, remembering we're the owners of both National Open Championships, we have a fantastic tournament on at Moonta Links this week, is that we need to run the Women's National Open Championship as well, because I suppose one of the things that Golf Australia represents, and one of the big things in my job, is that we are an organisation for men and women golfers. And so one of my priorities in the next 12 months is to make sure, unlike this year, that we actually have a Women's National Open run and get the chance to see those magnificent athletes as well.
Well, finally, let me ask you a question that seems to be tearing the fabric of the golfing community in Australia. Who's the better golfer, in your opinion, Greg Norman or Peter Thompson?
Oh, well, that's a very tough question. And I think, like most things...
Go on, just between you and me.
Just between you and me? Well, I think, like most things in life, you tend to, at a personal level, associate with somebody who you've grown up with. So I've just turned 40, and Greg Norman is 50, and... For me, he was inspirational in terms of how he took on the world. So, on the one hand, I've got to go with Greg Norman, but on the other hand, I know my father, who's just over 70, and some of his friends who play golf, would always argue that a 5-time British Open winner, who perhaps at the time didn't have the media coverage and so on, is just a legend. So it's maybe a legend versus an icon. I'm not sure I want to make a call.
I think you just have. Tony Hallam, congratulations on your appointment to the head of Golf Australia, and all the best with your vision.
Thanks, Mick. And any golfers out there, very keen to hear from you and let us know what your ideas and challenges are. So thanks very much.
The new Chief Executive Officer of Australian Golf, Tony Hallam. And that's the Sports Factor program for this week. Thanks to the production team of producer Andrew Davies and to our technical producer this week, Jim Usher. And thanks also to Sabrina Lipovic and Brian May in ABC Archives. Don't forget, if you'd like a transcript of the show or you want to download it as an MP3 file, then head to the Radio National webpage, abc.net.au/rn. All you need to do is to select the Sports Factor from the drop-down program menu and follow the prompts. And if you'd like to contact us here at the program, then you can send an email from the webpage as well. Brickbats and bouquets, equally welcome. I'm Mick O'Regan. Thank you for your company this week, and I hope you can listen next week to The Sports Factor here on ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.